Today, obesity affects more than 30% of adults in Missouri. But how did we get there? Join us for a live taping of KBIA's talk show Intersection, Tuesday, November 18th, at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Be part of the conversation with KBIA.
November 12, 2014, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Jim Flink and Jamie Gray. On our program this week, after more than 15 years, Stephen Glass breaks his silence. We've got another gate on our hands. It's Pointergate. What led a Minneapolis TV station to think the city's mayor was throwing gang signs? And Jake Gyllenhaal's new movie, Nightcrawler, shines light on overnight video stringers. We'll talk about what they do and if what you're seeing on the big screen looks at all like what goes on in real life. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but I want to start with President Obama's announcement on broadband internet access. Monday, Obama said that it is time that the FCC regulate the internet as it would any other utility and keep providers such as Comcast or Verizon from making you pay more for unfettered access.
Internet providers have a legal obligation not to block or limit your access to a website. Cable companies can't decide which online stores you can shop at or which streaming services you can use, and they can't let any company pay for priority over its competitors. To put these protections in place, I'm asking the FCC to reclassify internet service under Title II of a law known as the Telecommunications Act. In plain English, I'm asking them to recognize that for most Americans, the internet has become an essential part of everyday communication and everyday life.
So this looks like a big win for the net neutrality advocates, for companies like Netflix or Hulu. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's just an ask. It's a statement from Obama and the Obama administration. It's not even at a point of being proposed as law or anything of the like.
And that's because the FCC really doesn't have to listen to what the president mm-hmm. says in this case. The FCC is completely independent and will make this decision independently. I think what's interesting about this, though, is that the president has had a very good relationship with the FCC. In fact, three of the five sitting members were appointed by the Obama administration. This puts a little bit of strain on their relationship in some respects, but certainly it adds fuel to the pro-net neutrality folks who have been looking for a statement like this from the White House, just sort of a reiteration of that position.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, they don't have to listen to what he says, but, and I think he even mentioned this, there have been thousands upon thousands of statements from the public that have gone to the FCC, and so surely they're getting those. But this will be an interesting battle to watch play out. And I know some of the arguments come from the side of, well, it should be like real estate. You pay for prime real estate. You pay to be on the corner of whatever two popular streets. So should it be the same way on the internet? And I know that that's some of the argument, but we'll have to wait and see exactly how it shakes out, I guess.
Yeah, because unlike real estate, I mean, this is an exchange of information. This is about, in many respects, how many people in the democracy now get their information. They get it. They get it without overseers, companies like a Comcast or a Time Warner Cable or those kinds of companies saying, we're going to speed up this information. We're going to slow down this information. Mm-hmm. You're going to get it at with advertising or without advertising. And so there are all sorts of things that under a regulation and running it like a utility mean that there is every bit of an opportunity to make commerce out of it. But there's also some limitations in terms of what can be done with leverage. And that would tend to be on the other side of the argument, mm-hmm. Jamie, for people who are pro-net neutrality, the very gist of the argument.
Mm-hmm. Well, conservative talk show host Glenn Beck told fans that for the past few years, he's been suffering from a mysterious neurological illness.
The real reason we have made these changes, the real reason that you are seeing changes in me is my health. I was told by doctors just this last spring when we moved off the stage that I could no longer work as the way I had been working because it was literally killing me. About 5 years ago, right around the time we met in Washington, D.C. for 828, I had begun to have a string of health issues that, quite honestly, has made me look crazy. And quite honestly, I have felt crazy because of them. My vocal cord paralysis, my strange eyesight, problems. And at first, what we believed was just a simply very painful form of neuropathy. While I was at Fox, the pain would get so bad that my camera crew, God bless them, my executive producer, Tiffany, and our director, Sarah, worked out hand signals so they would know when to take the camera off of me. We didn't know at the time what was causing me to feel as though out of nowhere my hands or feet or arms and legs would feel like someone had just crushed them or set them on fire or pushed broken glass into my feet. I can't tell you how many nights my wife would sit in the light looking at the bottom of my feet to make sure that there really wasn't any glass in them.
Beck went on to say that he didn't want to reveal his health problems until now for a wide range of reasons, but chose to do so at this time because, at least right now, he's been able to stall the disease's progression. I watched about 45 minutes of the hour-long program. You saw about a minute and a half of it there. Jamie, you said you watched the whole thing. Beck himself said that that over the course of the last few years, he said some things that may have made him appear to be crazy. This still seemed like very much of a stream of consciousness discussion that went on for a very long time.
And very intimate details of his life. I mean, I think that little spot that was just played as an example of that, you know, some of the times that he's had at his home with his wife. But yes, it was kind of, it didn't seem super scripted. Of course, it had to have been because there were some video clips that were coming up as part of it, but seemed pretty candid in terms of recapping the last 5 years, but a little all over the place, I guess, stream of consciousness.
I found it to be disturbingly intimate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, welcome to the world of what many Americans are dealing with every single day, whether they have MS or whether they have some sort of muscular dystrophy. I mean,
ALS
being
one, ALS.
Being probably the most notorious of them. I think, you know, and it turns out that he has had some adrenal issues, and it turns out that he believes that his faith saved him, and I think that's all fine. And good, and it's an interesting and compelling story, especially for those people who love Glenn Beck. He has the microphone to be able to share that story, and so be that. But I also felt very much, as a person who was on camera for 20 years, and people think that they know you, and to be really honest with you, when you have a stage every day, your skew on reality gets a little bit askew. That is to say, you forget that the things that are happening to you happen to a lot of people. And that my takeaway from this was, Glenn Beck, you're experiencing what a lot of people are experiencing. And, you know, I to take nothing away from that, but it felt a little bit like that was some sort of awakening for him. Like, I can get ill too. And by the way, here's a guy who slept 2 to 4 hours a day for years and years and years. And a lot of people who have that problem get very ill.
Sleep deprivation becoming a definite symptom
contributor
to that. One of the things, though, that I took away from this more than anything, and this is as somebody who has worked as a producer, somebody who now both produces and hosts this show, he had said something about how he and his producers and his director at Fox had managed to work out hand signals, that they were communicating on such a level that this never had to become public while he was working there. And to me, this took this and elevated it beyond just the idea of Glenn Beck, but looking at the relationships that develop and how tight those bonds become between an anchor and their producer, and how one really does come in time to protect the other.
Yeah, and frankly, I'm shocked that it didn't come out before now, even if he wasn't telling many people. If you tell a few people something, especially in this type of industry, especially when you're talking about a personality who can be as polarizing as Glenn Beck, I'm pretty shocked it didn't come out. And he talked a lot about his wife even helping to kind of run a distraction while he would try and get out of the car, those types of things. So I was pretty stunned after hearing that they were Very loyal to him, it seems.
I will say, after leaving Fox, though, you know, his circle has become considerably smaller and considerably tighter with running the Blaze and some of the other things that he does. And so, in some respects, when it does get smaller, it gets more intimate. You close ranks and you really, really try to build on or support one another. And you do. You finish sentences. It's like a marriage. And you know, talk with any anchors who have anchored together for 20 years and they'll tell you, for good and for bad, it is like that.
And sometimes it doesn't even take 20 years. Travis McMillan and I have been working on this show for just about a year and a half, and we have hand signals. If we're starting to run low on time, I'll have a signal that you may not see if you're watching the video version of this, either online or on TV, but there are signs that Travis and I have that tell him, hey, we're skipping our next story or something along those lines.
Or having your magic TV husband and your TV wife. Like, I had a photographer, we joked that we were TV husband and wife. So that definitely does happen.
Okay. Well, some of those relationships that develop in a newsroom, that they result in a very close bond. And our next story is actually going to relate to one of those similar bonds as well. It's centering around former journalist Stephen Glass, who created a massive scandal in the late 1990s after fabricating dozens of stories while working at The New Republic. Well, he has now broken his silence. Glass spoke on the record to Hannah Rosen, who was one of his former colleagues and one time very close friend. She actually describes him in a story that appeared in The New Republic on Sunday as being almost like his little brother in the newsroom. In the story, Glass attempts to explain why he tried to pull off what some call one of the most elaborate frauds in journalism history. It's a fascinating read. Jamie, you told me you had just gotten through the whole thing yesterday. Your reaction?
I thought it was interesting to see this perspective, finally hear from Stephen Glass, not on his terms, if you will. We have heard from Stephen Glass in the years since all of the fabrication of dozens, maybe hundreds of articles that he had written. But now we hear from him not on his terms. And I thought it was interesting, particularly, he apologizes a lot. I guess he has been apologizing a lot. But it's interesting to hear from someone he was so close to, as you mentioned.
I think what's interesting about this is that he still needs something. And, you know, I think that the author of the article that I read said, you know, that was my concern all along, was why does he want to talk to me? What does he need from me? And in some way, and even lately, I mean, I think that that's the case. He's still trying to rectify, you know, a reputation, and not just his, that was ruined, reputations that were ruined 16 years ago, and still needs
repair. Well, and it goes into detail in the article, too. Not only does he need that in terms of repairing relationships, but he is still attempting to get admitted to the California bar.
Correct.
And character issues being called into question that has not yet been successful in doing that. It's interesting, though, and I want to ask you, do you think he ever has a chance at redeeming his reputation? And the reason I ask that is that Rosen says at one point in the article that she was trying to dig really deep to go back and feel and experience that pain and that betrayal that she felt back in the 90s, 15, 16 years ago. And she was having a really hard time finding that within herself again now that this time has passed. Do you think that our industry, that journalists as a whole, that we're going to start to feel, and even the public, begin to have some of that pain ease, and maybe Stephen Glass's mistakes won't seem as egregious one day?
No. He went too far for too long.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's unforgivable. As a journalist, as a reader, as a news consumer, what he did went too far for too long, and I can't overlook that. This wasn't one mistake that caused some people some pain. It was intentional.
And not just that, he was in the position of being sort of the fact checker for the organization for which he worked. So not only was he spinning these stories that frankly defied belief, and it's because none of them were true, but that he was also in charge of making sure that what the rest of the organization did was truthful, that was validated. And so he did. When it comes to sort of setting a new bar, and it's not a high one, it's a low one, for what journalists can do, the damage that they can do if they don't do their job well, he's pretty much the person that people look to and say, this is that guy. And so in that respect, can people forgive him? probably, though, I mean, it's clear that those who were closest to him and in some ways damaged most by him have forgiven him. That being said, I think that when you mention his name, fabrication is the next word that comes out or something like that.
I think you're more likely to forgive someone that you had a close relationship and I think people that had a close relationship also probably have their own personal guilt about the situation, just a guess, but I think there's a different way to look at things when you are on the inside versus what we have, which is I mm-hmm. don't forgive him and I don't really see a reason to.
So next, I want you to imagine a big city mayor goes to a get out the vote drive and takes photos with her constituents. Imagine she points at one of them and he points back. Imagine that person is black. Now imagine law enforcement sees it and for some reason thinks those hands are flashing gang signs. There you have it, the birth of Pointergate. That's Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodgett standing with an unidentified man pointing at each other. Fingers out, thumbs up, kind of in a gun-like formation. ABC affiliate KMSP TV got a copy of the photo and talked with some law enforcement sources who were none too pleased. Here's retired police officer Michael Quinn.
She's putting cops at risk.
Michael Quinn retired after 30 years as a police officer. 25 of those years were spent with Minneapolis police, where he also managed the internal affairs unit.
The fact that they're flashing gang signs back and forth at each other, showing solidarity with the gangs, she's legitimizing what they're doing. She's legitimizing these people that are killing our children in Minneapolis. And I just don't get it. It hurts.
Law enforcement sources tell us they found this photo on the man's Facebook page while they were doing investigative work. They say there's no evidence he belongs to a gang, but they say he has connections to gang members. Quinn says the photo creates a safety problem for every officer in every gang unit in the metro.
And she's giving the gang something to flash around and say, look, we've got the mayor on our side. Even the mayor's with us.
Quick correction on the call letters there. That's KSTP-TV. After that, a little bit later in the story, there was an interview with the head of the police union saying the mayor should know better and asking who she's going to support, the gangs in the city or the cops. Twin City viewers weren't impressed. The current police chief wasn't impressed. And the mayor's office wasn't impressed. Basic consensus here is that photo was taken completely out of context and that all she was doing was posing with a constituent.
Well, not just that. I mean, let's do a little bit of background research, shall we, and find out that the mayor has been at odds with the with the police force and with the police union for quite some time. And, oh, by the way, these folks might have an axe to grind with the mayor and may try to take something that doesn't have any context, that you haven't sought any context for, and, yes, maybe even blow it out of proportion. This is a situation where this television station, it would appear, very strongly would appear, was manipulated by the police force or the police union or someone in order to tell their story, to carry their water, and there wasn't much work done to even really try to present. The reporter says, oh, we tried to talk to the mayor. Well, the premise of the story is a little bit crazy, that a mayor, a sitting mayor, would be flashing gang signs with, oh, by the way, and this doesn't even go to racism or to a lot of the other issues that really bubble not very far underneath.
What was that hand gesture you just made there?
I did. Right? The thumb up and the finger out, right?
Yes, I think we have another Pointergate on
right,
our hands.
Right, there we
you
go.
You know, I think there were red flags. We saw in those interviews, in that story, they say that it's political. You don't even have to wonder if they have an axe to grind. They said, will the mayor be disrespecting us again or something. I'm paraphrasing there, but they said it's political, and as a journalist, you have to watch out. You do not want to be a pawn in a political chess match in your city. And it felt pretty obvious that that's what was going on.
And that's why the police chief said that she and her department weren't going to even dignify the story or make a statement, make a response, saying that they weren't going to be fueling the station's hysteria-driven segment.
I will say this, though. If there is a little bit of concern or this is a story that's out there, do you not report it? I'm not sure about that, but maybe you put a graphic up and say that there's been some, you know, concern brought to light, but you have to weigh out how much concern is there really, or are there a few concern people with an axe to grind? A concern with the photo. Is there really some sort of issue at hand? Do you report it? I'm not sure that there's a story here, though, in this situation.
Well, and if you go to our link section, you see that the mayor has a habit of taking pictures with fingers out, thumbs
exactly.
up. I mean, that's her
kind of
thing.
Her standard
and that's
pose.
The context.
You know, some people do the V for victory or peace sign
right.
or, you know, I don't know what other kind of hand gestures, the Charlie's Angels thing, although that's kind of another another gun-like gesture. But one of the other things that was interesting is that the photo was not, the person in the photo was not identified. But later, through additional research, it turns out that the guy has been identified as a volunteer with the group Neighborhoods Organizing for Change. And we've also added another video to mm-hmm. our links blog on KBIA.org, where you can take a look at video that group has posted on YouTube that describes the group and actually shows part of when the photo was taken and how there's this awkward interchange about how they were going to pose for it and what it would look like.
And we should say that the person is on parole that is in that picture. So, I mean, that part is probably, that's valid. But, again, completely out of context, completely not fact-checked. How did it get through that whole news organization and nobody said, wait a minute, this seems a little bit odd?
Well, interestingly enough, since you bring that up, the same reporter that was involved in this situation with KSTP tweeted yesterday after having gone silent on Twitter for a few days that he was going to have a story coming up last night. Muslim leaders asking the FBI to stop recruiting spies at Minnesota mosques. So.
Wonderful.
Perhaps he's
moving on. Yeah, he's going.
Maybe you've seen Jake Gyllenhaal's newest film, Nightcrawler. If not, this small bit from the trailer will help set up the premise for you.
We're first. Go around. Get a shot inside the car. Hey, back away.
I got it. I'm back.
Will this be on television?
Morning news. If it bleeds, it leads.
Are you currently hiring? I'm starting a TV news business.
You, get back!
I film breaking stories. Maybe you saw my item this morning with fatal carjacking.
No, I mean, I don't have a TV.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah.
Does it have GPS?
Yeah.
Congratulations, you're hired.
Gyllenhaal's character goes on to make quite a name for himself as a stringer, shooting crime scenes and selling his video to local news stations. One night, he gets the big get and finds a TV station willing to pay top dollar for his footage. I haven't seen the movie yet, but Jamie, you have.
I did, yes.
Tell us, based on what you've seen in the theater, how realistic does the whole premise and setup seem to you?
I always am hesitant to go into movies that I know are trying to portray television news because a lot of times it's cringeworthy, especially if you've been on the inside. In this case, I think you have to look at it more as a character drama and understand that Gyllenhaal is playing this very interesting character and kind of take the choices that he is making and the judgment calls that he is making as kind of a creepy character and not so much a representation of the news business. I think the thing that I see that's most unrealistic and that was played in that trailer is this idea of looking for gore and trying to find the goriest shot. It's not truly what happens in most cases. Usually, in fact, you are trying to get shots that do not have blood in them because you're not going to put those on television. Mm-hmm. It's against what we do ethically. I know those choices used to be different. I've pulled plenty of file tape where there's body bag shots from the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. I think that used to be something that was on local television quite frequently. Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore. I think that was, to me, the most unrealistic part of the movie. There's also some of the negotiations that take place for him to sell, for the stringer to sell his tape, I think, go a little bit farther than traditional negotiations.
And just before the show started, we talked about where some markets do pay for stringers, and you had that in Chicago.
Yes, as an executive producer in Chicago, I very often would work with stringers who would, early in the morning, offer me tapes, and I would have the option of choosing to either air them or not. We'd mm-hmm. pay somewhere between mm-hmm. $150 and $200 for a tape. The mm-hmm. stringer would drop it off at the station. We'd take a look at it. And if we decided to go ahead and use it, then we would go ahead and pay them. It was a set flat fee. And once you had it to use in perpetuity. So if you had file stories that, or things that you would go back to and do follow-ups, you would have it there. But almost every Stringer video would always look the same. So as opposed to having that big gory shot, what you'd usually have would be, you know, the street signs that show you exactly which intersection right. you're at, or the flames coming out of the building in the fire, right. or the aftermath of the car crash, just the car on the side of the road. In Kansas City, in Boise, in other markets, how did you handle that differently?
Generally, our policy was no, we do not pay for video, but on occasion, when we knew that there was something that was truly, truly distinct, that wasn't a car crash or a shooting, but it was something that really we felt mm-hmm. compelled, then we would talk with that person about paying. But in general, our policy was don't pay for that.
At the stations where I've worked, we've never paid, at least to my knowledge, never paid for any content. And I knew when I answered the phone, if somebody tried to sell us tape, that we would say no. And we knew that the other stations in our market were likely going to turn them down as well. I do think the one thing in the movie that is shown pretty accurately is that listening to scanners, going mm-hmm. out and trying mm-hmm. to find the news that yep. way. Yes, that absolutely does happen. We listen to scanners in newsrooms, news cars, and we go out and we try to get there first and get video to show the situation.
And you do arrive on the scene before police many times. Mm-hmm. You also are in situations that are very much like that movie depicts.
Okay. Well, before we leave you today, a story that's a little bit country and a little bit rock and roll, quite literally. Maybe you knew that season 2 American Idol runner-up Clay Aiken ran for Congress in North Carolina. And maybe you knew that he lost. Or maybe you didn't, and now you do. What you probably didn't know, though, is that during his entire campaign, he was trailed by a production crew for a reality program that will air on the Esquire network. The 4-hour docuseries is expected to run in February. It seems you weren't the only one not to know about that, though. It seems that there were some Hollywood actors and producers who had held some fundraisers on his behalf, and they now say they feel duped, not knowing that he was going to be having this reality series produced in the background. Jamie, one question I'd want to ask you, and Jim, you as well. For many years, you would cover campaigns. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you begin to notice if there was one crew that was always there that would leave right afterwards? One of these things didn't look like the other.
Well, I think, especially with campaigns, there's so much hurry up and wait. You end up talking a lot to the other people in the press and the media, especially if you're at a big campaign event. You end up talking to these people, and if somebody's there with a camera that you haven't seen before, you usually say, oh, hi, I work for so-and-so. Who do you work
for? Who are you?
I mean, I just find it really hard to believe that it was that under wraps.
Well, but in this day and age, so many candidates, so many products, so many companies, they have their own people. I mean, they're not relying just on journalists to tell their story. They're trying to tell their own story, and so they usually have their own crews. So I don't necessarily think that even journalists out in the field, they see that a candidate has a crew with them, and that's like check, cross-check, validate, we've got our own copy, let's get our copy against your copy, and let's see.
Would their crews have that high level of gear and of equipment, though, as you might see for a network docudrama team?
You wouldn't think so necessarily, would you? Just for validating, right? No, I mean, it does seem to be a bit of a disconnect, yeah.
Okay. And it seems like it would be a story that you might cover on the slow day of the campaign. Oh, there's a documentary crew with Mr. Aiken.
Yeah,
and
candidate, please do tell all of your supporters, hey, this is a group that's documenting what we're doing, at the very least.
Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. That's under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. They're all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions and see previews of what we will be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to our technical team, Travis McMillan, Austin Federa, Maya Jackson, and to our associate producers, Kendrisa Cockrell and Hope Kerwin. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.